So let's talk about your latest novel. You have written novels in the past. You have a portfolio that you issue now under your own imprint, which is Five Rivers Publishing. And your latest novel, which came out in 2019, or is it later than that?
No, it was 2019.
Okay. Yep. The Rose Guardian. Tell us about the book.
It is, I suppose, a common universal theme about family relationships, in this case, particularly between mother and daughter. And it's also about unspoken conversations, about confrontations that never happen, and how we tie ourselves up in secrecy and hurt and misunderstanding, where instead a very frank, open conversation might have resolved some of that. So that's the overarching theme of the novel. I chose to tell the story from three perspectives because I'm fascinated by the concept of what is truth. And everybody's truth is quite specific and individual. So in order to arrive at the truth of this story, I felt it required three perspectives. And that is of the mother, Una Cotter, who tells her story, if you will, from the grave. Her story is told through her journal entries. And those journals are bequeathed to her daughter, Violet. Now, Vi is a confused woman who is an artist. She's a painter and is trying to come to terms with her mother's death. And what does that mean? And the bitterness that is caused by the fact that she was never able to have those very frank conversations with her mom. And that's told from a first-person perspective and immediate. But then there's the third character, which is a little girl. Some people have likened her to a ghost. And in fact, what she is the manifestation of Vi's own childhood and unresolved issues. So there is this little girl, Letty, who appears in the novel, and her stories are very much told from her own perspective, that of a very young child, a child perhaps of about 5, 6, 7, around there, and the world that she escapes into because of traumas. So it almost has a feel to it of Labyrinth, that wonderful film that appeared many years ago. So it's that sort of almost dark fantasy that a child can construct when they're thrust into situations beyond their control, very adult situations. So yeah, those are the three perspectives. That was really hard to write.
Yeah, I can imagine it. And certainly, first of all, the context of truth is very much in vogue these days because of the last 4 years in the U.S. where we're really, you know, that whole situation with the Trump administration took the fake news that has been circulating around social media for the past number of years as people interpret their own truth and magnify it. And then that was magnified so much as a result of the Trump administration in the White House for the past 4 years. But it's interesting because perception is reality in a way. And if you spend so much time talking about what to you is truth, but it may not be based in fact, then it can come truth to you, and it can become truth to those around you if you articulate that often enough to the point where they start to believe it, and so on and so forth. Very interesting time to write that.
Well, it wasn't necessarily, I agree with you completely, Gordon, but it wasn't the story itself wasn't necessarily evolved out of the Trump administration.
No.
It takes me forever to write a novel, and in fact, this one took me 11 years. I was going back through some of my notes and realizing, good gravy, you were really slow doing this, Lorena. And I had a difficult time putting together the timelines. I ended up resorting to an Excel spreadsheet, in fact, so I could keep things straight. It's the first time I've ever done that. I mean, I outline my novels ridiculously detailed, but this one went kind of far beyond. And yes, that concept of truth has always fascinated me. I suppose in part because of some of my own background, growing up in to say my family was dysfunctional would be a bit of an understatement. They were certainly fascinating, larger-than-life characters in my family, which made for some fascinating dynamics. But truth was always very much there. So I suppose, in a way, writers write what they know. So I drew an awful lot from that.
We'll get back to how you craft a novel, because writers do it differently. But getting back to the relationship between the daughter and the mother is no longer there. The mother's deceased, and she's communicating to her daughter through her journal notes and entries. How does the daughter feel about the fact that, okay, it's like mom is communicating to me from the grave in a way that she wasn't able to before, or I wasn't able to appreciate that kind of insight in the past. But now I can't, because she's gone, I can't respond. I can't respond in kind. I can't tell mom what I'm thinking, even though she's now telling me from her grave what she's thinking.
On Vi's part, there's anger and bitterness and confusion. Her mother was a master gardener and had developed a particular type of rose, hence the one reason for the term, the rose guardian. It's called the white cotter rose. And had, over the course of her life, developed a garden research center for roses. So was a very dynamic woman, wouldn't take no for an answer, just kind of forged ahead. And so Vi had to live with, you know, that kind of a very larger-than-life personality. After her mom dies, there are those unspoken conversations. Their relationship had not been particularly good. And so when she's reading these journals, it's a complete enlightenment, because for the first time she's able to see not just the flaws that she already knew were there in her mom, but the pain, the hopes, the aspirations, the huge disappointments, betrayals, all of that that she had never had an opportunity to see, because her mom, when she was alive, presented this very strong woman, this fortress, if you will. So for Vi, it's very much an enlightenment. And because of that, she's also dealing with her own guilt about not attempting harder to have those conversations with her mom. You know, it deals with all of those complexities. There's never one easy answer, and I really wanted to put that forth, that we want life to be black and white, and it's not. Life is all about the gray.
At the same time, though, I mean, it's enlightenment for Vi, for the daughter, and she now appreciates perhaps what was going on in her mom's life. And also, stepping back, you also think that, okay, well, I'm not getting along with mom, and she doesn't get along with me, and that there's this divide between us, and one day we should take some time to figure this out. One day we should take some time to deal with this stuff, but I'm not going to do it today, because today I'm busy, and I don't really feel like it, and et cetera, et cetera. You always think that person is going to be there, and we'll get to that someday, you know, and then mom is gone, and you never dealt with that. Her mom's journal entry is helping Vi deal with that, but it's one-sided. And so the enlightenment, the big reveal of what's in the journal must be helpful, certainly, because she now understands and perhaps in a way it provides some kind of closure because she now understands what was going on there and why the distance may have been there. But at the same time, it's tragic because now she knows and she can't turn that around. She can't respond. She doesn't have that relationship because mom is gone.
That relationship never has an opportunity to evolve past the closed doors.
Right.
And I think that's a very common story. I know of, personally, lots of people who have had those kinds of relationships, family relationships.
Yeah.
And certainly I can attest to that myself. And although the story's not autobiographical, certainly there are elements in it that I drew from my own experiences,
mm-hmm.
I think as all writers do. But yeah, it is a story, you hit it on the nail, of both triumph and tragedy. And I think every valuable realization in life involves that complete spectrum. And I think it has to. Otherwise, it isn't a full realization. You're only looking at it from one aspect, and then that brings it back to the concept of what is truth or what is reality. Because truth and reality are often intertwined. And the answer is never black or white. The answer almost always is gray. There's an ambiguity to it all. And I think, I hope, that in this story that's illuminated, that while Vi, through her mother's journals, comes to understand her mom a lot better, there is still that sense of yearning, of longing for a relationship that never was and will never be. And accepting that, that's the other part of it, that sometimes we have to embrace the fact that maybe we can't fix a relationship. Maybe we can't have the kind of relationships that we really hope we will. But we can learn to accept that fact and to accept it with a sense of calmness and, I suppose, fatalism, if you will.
Yeah. Well, because we're all adults and we all have different lives, and we may, you know, I may wish, and I'm not speaking personally, but I may wish it, you know, if I have a sibling with whom I don't have a relationship and I'd like to, and I've reached out to that person and I've said, let's keep in touch. Let's, whatever there may be between us, let's resolve that and keep in the communication. And if there's no response on the other end, there's nothing we can do about that. We have reached out. And if the other person does not respond, then we do have to accept that. That's the way it is. And maybe one day there'll be a change of heart, or maybe not. But be that as it may, what are you hoping the reader will take away from this?
What I'm hoping for a reader to take away from this is an examination of self. Because the other part of this story is by examining herself. And that examination comes through the character of the little girl, Letty, who has these remarkably imaginative fantasies, not necessarily all hearts and roses. And for the little girl, Letty, there also is a fantasy creature called the Rose Guardian. And in her mind, one of the roses in her mom's garden comes to life and becomes a guardian for her. And her her favorite toys, big stuffed toys, are animated. They speak to her. So she has this coterie of friends in a very isolated and sometimes frightening world because she witnesses, you know, parents arguing, and sometimes there's violence, and she doesn't know how to deal with that. And the way a lot of children in those kinds of uncertain situations deal with it is to escape into a fantasy world. Now, Letty also ends up showing up in Vi's real life. Vi also, besides being an artist, she teaches summer school art courses for children. And one of the children that shows up is Letty. But she can't find any record of Letty in any of her enrollments, and Letty just kind of shows up, and then she disappears. And sometimes Letty allegedly causes some mischief or even destruction in Vi's studio, this kind of thing. So in a way, this is a manifestation of Vi's own nervous breakdown through the course of this novel. And In the end, if you don't mind, I'll read you the last paragraph. And it's important to preface this by saying that Letty keeps wishing to be able to go to a place she calls over there. And it has to do with sunset. And sometimes, you know, at sunset, the way the light hits the clouds, you can see a golden sea. And in the clouds, you can see perhaps another land, another shore. So Letty has seen this, and she calls that place over there. And sometimes she can see ships coming across that she calls Golden Sea. And these are the ambassadors who are going to come and take her away. They're going to take her over there to a place that's safe and wonderful, and there's laughter and all of that. And Vi has pretty much forgotten about who she was as a child, Letty. And so this child shows up and haunts her with her stories. Now, the end of the story is, and just I knew she would, there was Letty beside me on the bench, watching the gloaming, that distant bank of clouds, so like a faraway shore. Between us and the mirage over there, the lake became molten with light, and if you looked carefully, you could make out the specks of distant ships. My breath caught. I pulled Letty onto my lap. So, Letty Cotter, I said, looks like the ambassadors from over there are finally coming for you. I've waited so long. I kissed her cheek, feeling the cold air, feeling release, and she climbed off my lap, stepping to the end of the dock and beyond. I watched her go. It's a strange thing to witness part of yourself leaving, to know somehow you sent your heart out into the world. It's a perilous thing, this thing of love, and without it, we are fractured, unable to accept the wonder of a gift so simple as a trick of the light or the formation of clouds. And that's the ending of the novel.
That's quite powerful.
Thank you.
The process of writing, you said that you, when you're constructing a novel, you do map it out. You've got an outline. Mm-hmm. You know, I would assume how it's going to start, what the middle is, and how it's going to end. Like, how deep do you go with that?
I go really deep. I tend to do a Tolkien thing. I write way too much background information that is rarely ever used in the novel. But the process of that is to allow me to understand the characters, the world, the landscape, all of those intimate details, what they eat, what they the music they like, all of that. Most of that never appears in the novel, but as I said, that helped me to understand that entire world that I'm creating. Now, for the Rose Guardian, no, hang on, let's back up. Normally, I just do that in Word. I just do a chapter-by-chapter outline. So I do all my background stuff. I do all my character outlines. That's a separate document. But then I write a chapter-by-chapter outline that plots out exactly what's going to happen. And I do that so that I can keep track of all the sub-threads that will occur throughout a novel. And it also helps me then to insert any research that I have to do, because some of my novels require a great deal of either cultural lore or historical research. So I can insert that fairly seamlessly. Doing all of that ahead of time helps me, because not just to understand what's going on in the novel, and I can write fairly easily, but it also helps when when it comes to doing the revision. Getting the first draft out is one thing, but the art really happens when you come to a revision. So I find then in revision, I have a lot less work to do if I just spend that time ahead of time. Rose Guardian presented another whole dilemma for me, as I said, because I was writing three extremely distinct stories that somehow or other had to tie together so that the reader wouldn't get so confused that after 30 pages they'd close the book and walk away and go, I'm never reading anything of hers ever again. So that's why I resorted to an Excel spreadsheet so that I could map out side by side each of those stories and then be able to create some kind of a related timeline, even though one happened in the past, one happened in present, one happened in who knows when, but their themes could carry throughout the story, and that allowed me to juggle things around and revise without having to do all of that work in the actual manuscript.
Right.
It's a lot of time to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it saves time in the end. So.
And I guess that kind of thing, managing timelines and keeping things organized, keeping the various plot lines organized, is something that has to be done regardless of whether you and others who like to construct fiction that way, or at least in this particular story, do all that ahead of time. So you have a roadmap. You're on a trip. And you're not just setting out, heading west, and we'll see how far we get. You've got a roadmap. Okay, this is where I'm going, you know, and I booked the hotel for the first night and all the rest of it. As opposed to others who basically, they'll get an idea and they'll start. And then as the story progresses, then they will get into the nitty-gritty and they'll have to manage those things as the ideas come to them as they write. Then they have to stop and they have to organize that. Okay, I'm going to have to organize this part and file it for later somehow because I'm going to have to come back to it. Mm-hmm. So that organization happens, but instead of having it done ahead of time, which is what you have done, the other writer will get to a point in the story and then realize, okay, I'm going to have to stop and organize this because it's going to be chaos if I don't.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. I understand that. I've done a few novels that way where I've all my novels start with a concept, whether it's a tangible mm-hmm. one or an intellectual concept. Sometimes
right.
it's as nebulous as wind,
yep.
yep. which is what my current novel started with. And, you know, sometimes first chapter and last chapter get written just so you get a feel for it. But then, yes, you have
right.
to go back and
yeah.
and come up with the nitty-gritty, as you said. Yeah. This is something that I've told writers for years. Be your characters. Get in their skin and you become the character.
Yeah.
See your world through them. And if you do that, I think then you create a story that's very alive. Equally, you know, you can take all kinds of courses and listen to read all kinds of books that say, you know, do it this way, do it this way. But I'm 65 years old now, and I've come to realize that creativity will not be bound by rules. Sure, you have to pay attention to some of the rules because those are the foundations. But once you've laid that foundation, there are no rules. There is no one correct way of doing anything.
Yeah.
So you know the rules, and then I think art happens when you start to break the rules.
Yeah.
And get outside the box. That's the exciting part of doing anything creative. And you were talking about seeing things, being visual.
Yeah.
And hearing them. Sometimes this is why I paint as well, because I need to do a visualization of what it is I'm experiencing in this novel. And it really is another world that you can do escape into.
Where can people get the book?
You can get the book directly through my website, fiveriverspublishing.com, and it's available in trade paperback and ebook. I'm hoping perhaps later in the year to have it available as audiobook, but we're working on that. It's also available from your favorite online bookseller. So, yes, Amazon, Kobo. You can also order it from your local independent bookstore. They'll have to order it in. That's fine. And it's also available through e-library. So if that's your preferred way to read, you can get it there as well. So
great.
Lots of ways to be able to obtain it.
Excellent. It's nice to have so many avenues of access.
Mm. Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what are you writing now?
Oh, goodness. So this one is titled Hekia's Lament, and it's based on the Norse settlement at Lancel Meadows, 900 AD. So huge amount of historical research that's gone into that. And it's actually based on two real characters from the Vinland sagas, Haki and Hekja. They were husband and wife. They were captured as slaves, probably from Skapaflo. And it's her story of her journey. They both were given as tribute to King Olaf of Norway, who then gave them as a gift to Leif Erikson, who then gave them as a gift to Thorfinn Karlsefni. Thorfinn Karlsefni was responsible for one of the major expeditions there at Lancel Meadows. So, and Haki and Hekja actually went with Thorfinn Karlsefni to Lancel Meadows. So it's that story, and that's, we were talking about what inspires you. What originally inspired me is I want to write a story about wind, because that feeling of being buffeted by wind, of being pushed and harassed by wind, was something that fascinated me, sort of an environmental malevolence, the way that Thomas Hardy had written about the Moors. There was this deep, dark feeling of the Moors, and that persona floated through all of his novels. So in my novel, there is a constant sense of wind, but not just a gentle breeze, of strong wind, and that definitely plays out at the actual location of Lancel Meadows, where there is wind, strong wind all the time, and how that would affect the psyche and et cetera.
And the mystery of the wind, because a wind can be, as you suggest, a gentle breeze, but it can be so powerful, it can topple buildings. And that's a force that is frightening.
Yes. It's an implacable force.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of the implacable sense of the environment, the implacable sense of destiny, if you will, of circumstances completely beyond your control. It has no conscience or anything. It just is, and it is something you have to deal with. And so I thought that would be a fitting thing to have underlying this.
One good thing about this pandemic, perhaps, even though we can't go into a bookstore to peruse the shelves and pick up our favorite books, we can access them elsewhere safely, and they do provide for us an escape. Books have always done that, but no better time than now, because we do need that escape from, you know, the pandemic and speculation as to how we're going to get out of this. And in the meantime, we can escape into a good story.
Yes, and I think that's one of the beauties of literature, that if the writer has performed their craft well, they transport you to another time. I do love, there was a meme, if you will, that had been going around about being on a subway and looking up from your book, feeling completely shattered, and no one else quite knowing why it is that you're sitting there in this complete nervous breakdown.
Right.
It's because you've been in another world.
Yeah.
So I think that's a marvelous thing.
Well, Lorena, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you and about your book, The Rose Guardian, which, as you suggest, is available through the various venues such as Amazon and through your own imprint and such, and I wish you well with it.
Thank you very much, Gordon, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me about it.